Lecture 33, King Yoweh and Hushur.
Hello, it's good to be with you again. India entered the modern era as a British colony. Japan enjoyed rapid modernization, but then became enmeshed in its own colonialism and militarism and authoritarian rule, which led to its devastation during World War II. But China had the most difficult transition to modernity of all. In part, this is because the gap was so great between what China had been in the pre-modern era and then the position it found itself in the 19th century. In 1644, the Manchus, who were a pastoral people from north of Korea, came down and took over all of China in a military conquest, and then they legitimized their rule by becoming even more Confucian than the native Ming dynasty that they had overthrown. The Manchus were blessed with three very capable emperors who ruled from 1661 to 1796. So that's only three rulers in 135 years. It's tremendously stable. This is the Qing dynasty, the early Qing dynasty. Western visitors to China at that time, such as Jesuit missionaries, sent back glowing reports to Europe of a powerful, wealthy, intellectually vibrant country. And the Chinese, not entirely unreasonably, believed that they were the only genuine civilization in the world, and that foreigners ought to deal with the Chinese on Chinese terms, as tributary states. Now, obviously, China had goods that were in demand around the globe, but the outside world had little that China either wanted or needed. All of this had changed by the mid-19th century, when Western merchants and Protestant missionaries began arriving in China in greater numbers. The Qing dynasty at that time was in serious decline. The British had discovered that the Chinese would trade their silks and tea and porcelain for opium, and they had defeated China twice in two wars, 1842 and again in 1860, to force China to continue importing the drug. The government of China had barely survived a massive civil war called the Taiping Rebellion, which lasted from 1850 to 1864 and killed around 20 million people. Okay, this is the same time period as our own American Civil War, but if you compare the ratio of deaths to the total population, the Taiping Rebellion was more than twice as deadly. One of every 20 Chinese people died in the conflict, as opposed to one in 50 Americans in our own civil war. Chinese officials and intellectuals desperately began a program of self-strengthening in the 1860s and 70s to try to meet the challenge of the West, but they weren't particularly successful, and Western powers, along with Japan, began imposing unequal treaties and demanding access to the interior, not just for their goods and citizens, but also for their troops. And once they had investments in China, railroads or whatever, they wanted to send soldiers to protect them, and then eventually they wanted to take over territory entirely. Why wasn't China able to modernize as smoothly as Japan? Historians offer many reasons. China had a much larger territory and population to deal with. The government structure wasn't as strong as it was in Japan. And China, unlike Japan, didn't have a tradition of borrowing from abroad. This is sort of a new thing for China. There was much more foreign interference in China, and there was no alternate locus of political power. Okay, what that means is the Japanese could defy the shogun, but still claim to support the emperor. There really wasn't that sort of division possible in China. And the rulers of China could hardly stir up the forces of anti-foreign nationalism because, as Manchus, they themselves were technically foreigners. And everyone knew that. So China was defeated again and again. They lost the two opium wars to Britain. The country was devastated by the Taiping Rebellion. Then China lost the Sino-French War of 1884 to 85. And then, most humiliatingly, they lost the Sino-Japanese War 10 years later. The helplessness of the government was demonstrated yet again in the Boxer Rebellion of 1898 to 1901. It was an attempt to try to kick out foreigners, and it ended disastrously, with foreigners becoming even more entrenched into Chinese internal affairs and territory. It looked quite possible that China would soon be carved up by the Western powers. There were a number of Chinese thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries who put forward all kinds of proposals to save China, and they included traditionalists and adopters and westernizers and proselytizers. We're going to look at two great minds in this lecture, Kang Youwei and Hu Shi. Now, I'm comfortable enough classifying Hu Shi as a westernizer, but Kang Youwei is a complicated figure who resists easy categorization. It seems like he was an adopter in public, but a proselytizer at heart. We'll start with Kang. In the late 19th century, Westerners such as Yan Fu were beginning to argue that Confucianism was what was holding China back. Yan Fu had made translations into classical Chinese of key Western texts such as Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. But what really caught the attention of Chinese intellectuals of the day was Yan's first big translation. It was Thomas Huxley's Evolution and Ethics. You may recall that Thomas Huxley had a nickname. He was sometimes called Darwin's Bulldog. And this book, Evolution and Ethics, introduced to China the ideas of natural selection and the survival of the fittest. Particularly distressing to the Chinese, however, was the notion of social Darwinism, that nations, like species, were locked in deadly competition with each other. Clearly, China was losing. And as I said, some people were starting to blame Confucius. Traditional Confucian attitudes of deference, politeness, and morality had to be replaced with Western-style individualism and aggression and nationalism. Kang Youwei, in contrast, argued that Confucius could still be China's salvation. Kang was born in South China near Canton. He was a brilliant student who received a traditional education in the Confucian classics, but he was also a student of Buddhism, and he visited foreign settlements in Hong Kong and Shanghai, reading whatever he could find in translation about the West. Like Wang Yangming, Kang had a mystical experience as a young man in which he came to realize that I and all things are one. Afterwards, he never lacked for self-confidence. In 1895, he passed the highest level of the civil service exams in Beijing. Remember, that's going to be a qualification for being a leading scholar in the classical sense. And then Kang led other candidates in urging the emperor to reject the peace treaty with Japan and modernize the country. This is after the Sino-Japanese War. By the time Kang had taken the exam, he was already a well-known scholar, having published a book suggesting that the ancient text versions of the Confucian classics were forgeries of the later Han Dynasty in the first century AD. Okay. I know this is going to sound a little obscure to you, but often in China, debates about significant contemporary issues take the form of arguments about historical events. So we're going to go way back, way, way back, to the beginning of Imperial China in 221 BC. Do you remember how the first emperor banned all books except for medical and agricultural texts? After his Qin dynasty quickly collapsed, after about 15 years, the Han dynasty came into power, and scholars tried to recover those lost Confucian classics. They began by getting elderly scholars who had memorized the text to write them down in the new form of Chinese characters that the first emperor had regularized. This is the new text versions. Somewhat later, actually a couple centuries later, old copies in an ancient unreformed script that had been hidden in the walls of Confucius's home and elsewhere, and these were discovered. And these are going to be the ancient text scripts. Now, controversy broke out immediately. People wondered, like, where did these texts actually come from? Could they have been forgeries? But the ancient text scholars, with their more conservative, rigorous approach to the classics, eventually won out. All of this matters to Kang Youwei because the ancient text versions were the basis of Neo-Confucianism. Okay. Now, he's an advocate of the new text school, so he could argue that Zhu Xi's interpretations, which had been accepted as orthodoxy in China for 700 years, those interpretations were based on a fraud on the old text versions of the classics. The real Confucius said something quite different. Now, it turns out that Kang was actually wrong about the whole forgery thing, but stay with me here. According to the new text tradition that Kang's going to put himself in, Confucius had been a semi-divine figure, an uncrowned king, and Kang Youwei picks up that long-ignored strand in Chinese thought and runs with it. Confucius, he said, was not a backward-looking reactionary. Confucius, in his time, was a democratic reformer, even a prophet, and he still would be able to lead China into the modern era. In his next book, Confucius's Reformer, Kang suggested that Confucius had foreseen human history as progressing through three stages: the age of disorder, which is absolute monarchy; And then that would give rise to the age of approaching peace, which would be constitutional monarchy. And then eventually we would have the age of great peace, which would be characterized by rule by the people. Those terms and that whole idea of the three stages of history is borrowed from Dong Zhongshu, one of our great minds from the lecture on Han Confucianism. Okay. Obviously, at least the Kong, the next step for China was to follow the lead of Britain and Japan in establishing a constitutional monarchy. Okay. This is great because just as the samurai could say of their radical restructuring of Japan, we're not against the emperor, we're just against the false authority of the shogun. In a similar way, Kong Youwei could say, I'm not against the real Confucius, I'm just against those mistaken Neo-Confucians. And so that means that everything can be reformed. We can do whatever we have to do in order to preserve our nation, but we'll still be following Confucius, the greatest reformer of all. In 1898, Kong and his students had a chance to put their ideas into practice. The young Guangxu emperor had for several years been dominated by his aunt, the Empress Dowager Cixi, who had acted as his regent. In 1898, she retired and stepped back to give him more authority. He was interested in reform, and he invited Kong Youwei to court. The emperor was 26 years old, Kong was 40. Thus began the famous 100 Days of Reform, when the emperor, guided by Kong, issued a series of sweeping edicts calling for the modernization of education, a government administration, the economy, the military, and the creation of popularly elected local assemblies. In many ways, the emperor was following Kong's reform memorial of 1895, in which he had written of the need to build railways and a commercial fleet, to restructure the bureaucracy, to develop a national bank, to raise taxes, to establish mines and factories, and to start a postal system. Okay. These ideas were mostly adopted from the West, but Kong isn't strictly a Westernizer, since this reform program was put forward within the context of Confucianism. He gives a Confucian rationale for all of this. In the end, very little of this grand overhaul of China was actually implemented, because after 3 months of this, the Dowager Empress, with the backing of several conservative generals, staged a coup in which the emperor was put under house arrest for the rest of his life. That was only 10 years, unfortunately. And then the reformers were summarily executed, at least the reforms that they could catch. Six of them died, but Kong himself managed to escape to Hong Kong, and then from there he went to Japan. Now, I know that I've sometimes spoken of Japan as the bad guy in East Asia, and they will indeed go on to do some pretty horrible things. But in 1898, Japan looked like a model for Asian modernization. Over the next few years, some 10,000 Chinese students would enroll in Japanese universities, military academies, and technical schools, where it was cheaper than studying in the West, it was closer, and Japan and China shared cultural elements like the Chinese characters and the Confucian heritage, and that made for easier cross-cultural communication. A lot of the terms for modernization were actually first coined in Japan, even though they're Chinese terms. Kong Youwei continued to build support for reforms in China from his base in Japan, and then from even further abroad as he traveled the globe visiting overseas Chinese communities. Clearly, the status quo in China was untenable, and eventually the government there made some changes. For example, the civil service exams were discontinued after 1905, but it was too little too late. In 1912, the last emperor abdicated the throne, and a Chinese republic was proclaimed. Over 2,000 years of imperial rule in China came to an end that day. Actually, it was a republic in name only, and the real power was held by regional warlords. Kong felt that the time wasn't right for the age of great peace. Remember, that's rule by the people. He said that China still needed a constitutional monarchy. He was involved with two attempts to restore the emperor to power, to bring back that monarch. That happened in both 1917 and then again in 1924. Both attempts failed miserably, and Kong found himself in a somewhat awkward position. Without having changed his ideas much, Kong had gone from being a radical reformer in 1898 to being a reactionary has-been by the 1920s, and his defense of the Manchu emperor steadily lost ground to Sun Yat-sen's appeals for real revolution and for republican government without any sort of sovereign. The pace of change in China had left Kong Youwei behind. Sort of. There are some other ways in which Kong's thought would be considered radical even by our own standards, more than 100 years later. When I first mentioned Kong Youwei, I described him as an adopter in public and a proselytizer at heart. Let me explain what I mean. Kong had always had grandiose ideas. For instance, he wanted to make Confucianism the official religion of China, with Confucius revered as a godlike founder of that faith. But most people didn't realize how radical Kong's thinking was until his Book of Great Unity was published in 1935, 8 years after his death. In that work, Kong spelled out exactly what he had in mind when he spoke of that third and greatest age of human progress. Kong wrote of a utopia of one-world government, where nations and social classes and race would all come to an end. Race would come to an end through intermarriage, he thought. The family, as well, would become obsolete, with government-sponsored nurseries and schools and retirement homes taking care of the young and the elderly. There would be perfect equality between the sexes, and marriage would be replaced by one-year renewable contracts between men and women, or even same-sex couples, for that matter. There would be no more war or private property. Elaborate funerals would be replaced by cremation, and then the ashes would be used for fertilizer. Think of how shocking that would be to Confucian sensibilities. The world would be unified by a single language, and constant technological progress would mean an end to poverty and disease. I mean, Kong really wants to change the world. He thought that the newly discovered force of electricity was actually run, or benevolence, remember, human-heartedness, that Confucian virtue that earlier scholars had regarded as the glue that holds the cosmos together, and which could also be identified with qi, or material force. So remember, Zhu Xi talked about li and qi, and Kong Youwei says he doesn't like Zhu Xi much, but he does like qi, and he says that's actually electricity. Now, it may seem strange to us now, but it reminds me of contemporary figures who try to tie their philosophical ideas to developments in modern physics like quantum mechanics. I know that Kong Youwei's Age of Great Peace sounds something like a communist paradise, but his ideas were not derived from Marx. Instead, he found precedence in the long history of Chinese thought, including Mozi, remember, who talked about universal love, and Mencius, who was so optimistic about human nature, and in Buddhism. Not surprisingly, Kong was admired by Mao Zedong, whom we'll talk about in the next lecture. For those of you with a more practical bent, however, our next great mind is a young contemporary of Kong's named Hu Shi. He lives from 1891 to 1962. Hu Shi was born in Shanghai, and at the age of 19, he went to study in America. Actually, he was on a Boxer Rebellion indemnity scholarship. When it was discovered that the U.S. had collected more in war reparations than they had originally demanded in the treaty, some Chinese said, well, why don't you give us back that extra money? And Americans said, no, we won't give it back, but what we will do is we'll use that money to bring bright Chinese students to America for college. There were some 1,300 Chinese students who went to America on that scholarship program from 1909 to 1929. Actually a great idea. Hu Shi earned a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Cornell University and then a PhD from Columbia, where he studied with the great pragmatist philosopher John Dewey. Hu Shi's dissertation was titled The Development of the Logical Method in Ancient China, and he was one of those first people who looked back at the late Mohist logicians. Kind of like Muhammad Iqbal, you remember his dissertation was on Persian metaphysics. Hu Shi is somebody who's trying to explain the heritage of Chinese thought to Westerners. After 7 years in America, Hu returned to China, this is 1917, where he began teaching at Beijing University. There were a number of progressive thinkers on the faculty there, I would call them Westernizers, and they were promoting the new culture movement, which would bring science and democracy to China, along with equal rights for women, so they were against foot binding and arranged marriages and concubinage. They also gained some notoriety for their attacks on Confucianism. Hu Shi was best known as a champion of vernacular Chinese. For over 2,000 years, all serious literature and thought, and even the radical ideas of Kong Youwei, had been written in classical Chinese, the language of Confucius and Mencius. It's as if Latin had been used exclusively by scholars from Roman times until the 20th century, and there had been dozens of Ciceros in between who had coined expressions and shaped the language. The advantage of this is that scholars from all over China, who spoke mutually unintelligible dialects, could nevertheless communicate with each other through classical Chinese. But the written language had become more and more removed from what people actually spoke. Hu Shi argued that the Chinese should write what they said to each other, and that a standard dialect and a colloquial national literature would soon follow, as they had in European countries. There used to be lots of forms of French, and then eventually there's sort of a standard French and then a literature that came from them. So this language reform of writing in the vernacular would make it easier to express new ideas, but it would also make basic literacy possible for many more people. Hu Shi held up classic novels like Journey to the West as examples. Okay, remember Xuanzang, the Chinese monk who went to India to get the scriptures, and then Monkey was along with him. Okay, that was written in the vernacular, but it wasn't considered serious writing. And Hu Shi said, no, it's actually pretty good writing. According to Hu Shi, a dead language cannot produce living literature. This is a big deal, because changing the written form of the language, by doing that, Hu Shi is making it possible for Chinese thinkers to escape the stranglehold of the past. Similar language reforms were happening at about the same time in Japan, and then also in Korea, where, as you may recall from the last lecture, that Hangul alphabet of King Sejong was finally taking hold after 450 years. Okay, let me be clear. The Chinese characters haven't changed, and they're still hard to learn, since you need to know 3,000 or 4,000 characters to be literate. But they're being used in a new way. So, for example, there's a Chinese sound, gu, with a third tone, and there are several characters that all share exactly the same sound. There's a character that means ancient, and a gu that means valley, and one that means thigh, and one that means drum, and a gu that means bone, and a gu that means merchant, and one that means grain. When you're looking at that in a written form, it's easy enough to see what's going on, because they all look very different. But when you hear that, it's harder to distinguish those. So what Chinese end up doing is combining words. So they'll say something like gu dai, and you say, oh yeah, that's the gu that means ancient, or gu tou, and that's the gu that means bone. Even now, Chinese, when they can't quite understand each other, will sometimes trace a character on the palm of their hand for someone else. They say, oh yeah, that's the character that you have in mind. So the colloquial Chinese uses multisyllabic words. Written colloquial Chinese was taught in elementary schools starting in 1920, and then journals began to publish articles and stories in the vernacular. The most important of these journals was called New Youth, and it was edited by a colleague of Hu's at Beijing University, which had published his article. So this article is in New Youth. It's called A Preliminary Discussion of Literary Reform, and that came out in 1917. In that article, Hu Shi put forward several guidelines, including do not imitate the ancients, do not use allusions, do not use parallelism, because it's not just the characters and the single characters, but this sort of flowery language with lots of famous phrases was what you needed to be literate. When he says do not use parallelism, he gives an example of the opening lines of the Tao Te Ching. The way that can be spoken of is not the constant way. The name that can be named is not the constant name. You can see that parallel structure. Don't do that, Hu Shi says. The galvanizing event in the New Culture Movement came in 1919 in what we now call the May 4th Movement, just a few months after the March 1st Movement in Korea. That was the massive anti-Japanese demonstrations with this Declaration of Independence that Han Yong-un was involved in. The turmoil in both cases, Korea and in China, came from the excitement caused by Woodrow Wilson's speech about the 14 points the year before, and the disappointment with what was actually hammered out at the Paris Peace Conference that ended World War I. The backstory is that in 1914, Japan entered the First World War as an ally of Britain and France, and then they sent troops to the Shandong Peninsula in China and took over German territories there. That was sort of their bit for the war. Those territories included the Qingdao Brewery. That's T-S-I-N-G-T-A-O. You may have had an occasion to drink Qingdao beer before. That was established by German settlers in 1903. China also joined the Allies in 1917. They didn't send any combat troops, but they sent 140,000 laborers to France. And China expected something in return from the West for that effort, and they were shocked to learn that Japan had signed a secret agreement with Britain and France and Italy several years before the end of the war, giving Japan permanent possession of Germany's old territories on the Chinese mainland. On May 4th, 1919, 3,000 students from 13 colleges and universities in Beijing assembled in front of the Gate of Heavenly Peace outside the Forbidden City. The Gate of Heavenly Peace is the Tiananmen, right? And you've heard of Tiananmen Square. So that's where they are. And they were there to protest the Versailles Peace Treaty. When they burned the home of one of the officials involved, the police came down hard and arrested over 1,000 students. They actually had to turn part of Beijing University into a jail to hold them all. There were hundreds of sympathetic strikes and demonstrations and boycotts all over the country, and the government eventually backed down. Students were released, cabinet ministers resigned, and China never signed the Versailles Treaty. Okay, believe me, the students who were occupying Tiananmen Square on May 4th, 1989, the 70th anniversary, knew this history, though their own protest ended tragically. With the May 4th movement, there was a shift to mass politics and ideology as the basis of nationalism. Hu Xie favored a more thoughtful, deliberate sort of westernization, and he wrote an article in the summer of 1919, a few months after this massive demonstration. This article was called "More Study of Problems, Less Talk of Isms," in which he observed that the slaves of Confucius and Zhu Xi have decreased in number, but the slaves of Marx and Kropotkin have appeared. Kropotkin, of course, was a proponent of anarchism. Above all, Hu Xie was a pragmatist, as one might expect from a student of John Dewey, willing to try out various approaches and go with what actually worked. Very roughly, pragmatism is the philosophical position that something is true if it works. To Hu, education, careful study, and gradual change seem much more promising than impetuous revolutionary action, however emotionally satisfying that might be. Again, from his article, "More Study of Problems, Less Talk of Isms," he says this: "We don't study the standard of living of the rickshaw coolie, but rant instead about socialism. We don't study the ways in which women can be emancipated or the family system set right, but instead we rave about wife-sharing and free love. We don't examine the ways in which the Anfu clique might be broken up." This is a notoriously corrupt government faction. "But instead we rave about anarchism. Putting it bluntly, this is dream talk." In the years following 1919, a number of distinguished foreign visitors came to China, most of whom met Hu Xie. There was John Dewey and his wife, who were in China from 1919 to 1921. Of course, that was his old professor. The logician, philosopher, and pacifist Bertrand Russell came for 9 months in 1920. In 1922, both Albert Einstein and Margaret Sanger, the advocate of contraception, visited. Even Rabindranath Tagore did a lecture tour in China in 1924. He warned the Chinese against the wholesale adoption of Western values, but many in his audiences were impatient and eager to throw off their Chinese past. Hu Xie himself went on to serve as China's ambassador to the U.S. from 1938 to 1942. That's the beginnings of World War II in China, sort of a difficult era. And then after the war, he became the chancellor of Beijing University from 1946 to 1948. When the communists took control of China in 1949, Hu Xie went to New York, where he lived until 1958, when he joined the nationalists in Taiwan to become president of the Academia Sinica, Taiwan's premier research institution. But as early as 1921, it was clear that Hu Xie would break with some of his more radical colleagues at Beijing University, who believed that China would be saved by some of those isms that he had warned against, particularly communism and its teachings of class struggle, capitalist exploitation, and violent revolution. In the next lecture, we'll take up the story of how China under Mao Zedong, perhaps surprisingly, ended up adopting this foreign ideology as the answer to all their problems. But I'll end this lecture with a quote from John Dewey. As I said, this is Hu Xie's teacher back at Columbia. While in China, Dewey was amazed at the excitement over philosophical and social ideas that seemed to bore his American students. He reported, "There's an eager thirst for ideas beyond anything existing, I'm convinced, in the youth of any other country on earth." But this intellectual fervor was the result of China in the 1920s being in the midst of a dramatic social transformation where it wasn't clear at all what path ought to be taken, and the consequences would be a matter of life and death for many of those in his lecture audiences, as we'll see next time. See you then.